Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Evelyn Forget, Professor of Economics and Community Health Sciences at the University of Manitoba, Canada, explores, is a basic income good for your health? This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 18th of September 2018.
I'm delighted to be here tonight, and thanks so many of you for coming out and letting me talk about my all-time favorite topic. I thought long and hard about the title that I was going to start with today, and really what I should have up here is Lessons from Canada, How Not to Run a Basic Income Pilot. What I'm going to talk to you about today are two experiments that have taken place in Canada. The first one was during the 1970s, the old Mincome Project. It was an almost forgotten Canadian experiment for a number of reasons. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I was able to uncover some of the data associated with that project and to come up with some of the outcomes for the population in terms of health, in terms of mental health, in terms of human capital accumulation, education, and so on. And that particular project served as the basis for the Ontario Basic Income Experiment that was announced in 2017 and prematurely canceled in July 2018. And finally, I think I'll just summarize some of the avenues that I'm working on now and raise some issues that we can be thinking about going forward. So let me take you back in time to 1974. 1974, the federal government in Canada and the province of Manitoba came together with a whole series of high hopes about a guaranteed annual income. This project put money into people's hands for a period of 3 years, between 1975 and 1978. And the sole purpose of that project, from the point of view of the two levels of government in Canada, were to find out what would happen to people's labor market behavior if you gave them a guaranteed annual income. In particular, would people quit their jobs? Would they work less? Would we be paying for it in terms of reduced productivity and so on? Just to set the stage, the province of Manitoba sits in the center of Canada. And in 1974, it was an agriculturally dependent province. There's one urban center. There's still one urban center in Manitoba called Winnipeg. And Winnipeg was one of the two sites of the experiment. Winnipeg was set up as a randomized controlled trial. And what that meant was that researchers went into the town of Winnipeg, the city of Winnipeg, which had almost 500,000 people at the time, and they chose a small proportion of the total population, and they randomized people into the treatment group, which would receive the guaranteed income, and the control group that wouldn't. And the idea was that at the end of a three-year period, they could compare outcomes for the two groups and find out what the impact of the basic income was. The second site of the experiment was the town of Dauphin, Manitoba. And that was a town of about 10,000 people. It was an agriculturally dependent town. It's a little bit smaller today than it was then. And the unique thing about Dauphin is that it was a saturation site. So very much like the Scottish pilots, everybody in Dauphin was invited to participate in the experiment. Now, I should say that that doesn't mean everybody in Dauphin got money. This was a means-tested benefit. It was set up as a negative income tax. So if people had no money from any other source, they received a certain amount of money. If they worked for a living, if they earned a wage, their benefit would decline, but it would decline less than proportionately. In Dauphin, it would decline by 50 cents for every dollar earned. So it was a fairly steep trade-off in terms of the benefit, and it was very much focused on low-income people. In Winnipeg, because the focus was on the labor market, they tested a number of different payout and tax pact designs. But I'm going to talk primarily about Dauphin. So what happened to the project? Well, the project ran its full course. The families were paid for the full 3 years. Data was collected. The experiment lasted for the full planned term. But there was no analysis done. There was a great deal. If you think back to the 1970s, this was across the world. It was a period of economic and political turmoil. And that had an impact politically. The provincial government, which was paying 25% of the cost, fell in 1976. And the Social Democratic government was replaced by a Conservative government. And the project lost provincial support. Federally, there was a Liberal government in power, but it was a minority government, and all kinds of other things were happening in the economy in the 1970s. This was a period of time when inflation rates were hitting 10, 12, 13%. Interest rates were going to 18 or 20%. A lot of middle-class people were losing their houses. There was a great deal of unemployment. And the idea at the beginning of the 1970s was that we were in a position to do something about poverty. By the time the 70s ended, people were very much focused on other aspects of the economy. And the idea of a basic income just sort of fell off the political agenda. So the experiment ended as planned. The families received the money, and then the researchers made a tactical error. So this is one of the first mistakes, I think, that we made. The researchers made a tactical error. They dug their heels in and said they weren't doing the analysis unless they received the money to do the analysis. The government said, right then, archive the data, and sometime in the future, maybe somebody will look at it. So for the next 15 years, a number of people tried to get access to the data, and there was an attempt made on the labor market data for the Winnipeg site only, published in 1991, which tried to answer the basic question that the experiment was set up, was essentially designed to answer. That is, would people quit their jobs if you give them a basic income? And surprise, surprise, they found that people really don't quit full-time jobs in order to live on the kind of payments that were associated with the income design. Adult males reduce their work effort really very modestly, women slightly more. But there were two groups of people that had larger reactions. First of all, 1970s, legal entitlement to maternity leave in Canada was about 4 weeks. And it turned out that a lot of women thought that that was a short maternity leave. And they decided to use some of the money that they received as a stipend through the Mincome Project to buy themselves longer parental leaves when they gave birth. So they were in effect anticipating some of the changes in social policies that we've actually introduced in the subsequent 30 years. The second group of people who had a much larger reaction were, and here the language is tremendously important, young unattached males. It turns out that young unattached males significantly reduced their work effort. And this seemed to fill all of the stereotypes people had. If you give people a basic income, these young men are just going to run away from their responsibilities, they're going to quit their jobs, they're going to stop working. This is something we need to worry about. So that's where the project ended for a long time. About 20 years later, I decided to go looking for those young unattached males. And I was primarily interested in questions of quality of life, education, and health, and in particular, mental health outcomes. But I decided that those young unattached males were a really good place to start. So I went looking for the data. And when you're told by the federal government to archive the data, it's not entirely clear. I think it's certainly in my mind, it wasn't entirely clear what that meant. It turned out that there were 1,800 cubic feet of data. That means 1,800 banker's boxes stuffed full of paper records. Remember, this is the 1970s. There are key punch cards. There are mimeographed sheets that people filled, completed with pens. This was sitting in boxes, some of it well organized, some of it a little less well organized, along with letters that people had written to the researchers complaining about the project, commending them for the project. All kinds of things are in those boxes. The labor market tape that those guys had developed earlier to find out what happened in Winnipeg, of course, had become obsolete by the time I got around to it. No way to use that. I had the paper data. And I decided that my life is finite. I wasn't going to read all the papers sitting in those boxes, so I needed another way to get at the data. And I decided to focus on the small town of Dauphin, the secondary site of that experiment, in particular because it was a saturation site. And I was interested in the broader social outcomes that come about when you introduce a basic income. How does society itself change? And the first thing I did was, as I said, to go looking for those young unattached males. And here I'm going to change the language a little bit. What do we mean when we talk about young unattached males? Well, in Dauphin in 1974, what we meant are 16-year-old boys. And if they're not working, what are they doing? Well, it turns out one of the things they were doing was going to math class. They stayed in high school. And when I tracked down some of these guys and talked to them about their lives, the one thing they told me was that they had been under, kids from low-income families had been under a fair amount of family pressure to become self-supporting as quickly as they could, especially the boys, because there were reasonably well-paying jobs for strong young boys during the period. And so they should go out, they should support themselves, and the family's money could go to the younger kids. When Mincome came along, suddenly the families had more money, and a lot of those families decided that they could support their sons in school just a little bit longer. So what you see here, it can be thought of as high school completion rates. So the light, I'm not sure what these colors are, the light mauve line there represents Dauphin. The dark purple line represents Winnipeg, and the cream-colored line is the rest of Manitoba. It's sort of a control group. And I've got this sorted by year. And you can think of these as high school completion rates. Let me just turn this on. Is this? Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If you think of these as high school completion rates, you see that until 1974, there's virtually no distinction between Dauphin and the rest of rural Manitoba. But the dark purple line, as you might expect, is a little bit higher, which is exactly what we'd expect. Kids in the urban center are more likely to complete high school, to complete grade 12, than kids in the countryside. And Dauphin is pretty much like the rest of rural Manitoba. Come along here to 1974. Families start receiving money under Mincome. And the first thing that happens is that that light purple line increases. More kids are finishing high school. In fact, more kids in Dauphin. The rate of high school completion goes up in Dauphin relative to Winnipeg. So more kids in this little town are completing high school than even their urban counterparts. You go over here to 1976, and the line goes above 100%. Kids who'd left school, who'd taken jobs, were actually coming back to school to finish high school. 1977, 1978, the families are receiving money, and kids are completing high school. Almost 100% of the kids in Dauphin are completing high school during that period. Money stops flowing in 1979, and Dauphin goes right back down to where it started from, just the same as the rest of rural Manitoba, with the urban kids more likely to complete high school. You can ignore 1980. They messed up my data. They built a couple of big high schools just outside of Winnipeg. But you see this nice little bubble of high school completion rates exactly coincident with the Mincome project. So the young unattached males we're talking about were actually 16-year-old high school boys. The Mincome payments to their families allowed them to stay in school for another year or two. And before I talk about the rest of this project, I just want you to imagine the differences in the life track of these kids in 1974, the differences in opportunities between people who finished high school in the mid-1970s and people who didn't. The people who didn't finish high school certainly got jobs. They got jobs working in manufacturing, in agriculture. Both those industries have been devastated in the past 40 years. So if they left high school without a high school completion degree in the mid-1970s, they would have suffered bouts of unemployment, lower lifetime wages. They would have had far fewer opportunities to offer to their own kids. But I was also interested in effects on health and the quality of life, and I was really, really lucky. Canada had introduced universal health insurance just before this period. By 1971, it was introduced and implemented in Manitoba. And one of the things we all know is that universal health insurance collects a great deal of data. And what I was able to do was to go into the database. We've got probably 120 different databases that are linked around two numbers. If you've lived in Manitoba at any time between 1971 and the present, I've got you in that database identified by a 9-digit personal number and a 6-digit family number. So I can track family formation over that period. I can track changes in family outcomes. Addresses, 6-digit postal codes are updated every 6 months. So I can link you to the census and pull out a lot of data from that. More recently, we've got it linked to social data, to educational data. So I can actually find out quite a lot about people just from this anonymized database. And one of the things I was able to do with that database is to set up a control group. One of the problems you have with the saturation site is that there's no control group, and it's always difficult to determine what's causing the effects you observe. You introduce a basic income, and people seem to be better off, but are they better off because they got a basic income, or did something else happen to bring about those results? And so I was able to set up a control group for everybody who lived in Dauphin. Every person in Dauphin was matched with three other similar people living in similar towns. They were matched on a number of personal, family, and community characteristics. And then I looked at the data to find out what happened to them. Now, I don't know how sick they were or how healthy they were, but I do know whether they used hospitals or not. And the dark blue line here represents Dauphin. The red line represents the control. So before MnCom came along, people in Dauphin were about 8.5% more likely to be hospitalized than people in the control group. When MnCom came along, those two lines start to move together. And by the end of the MnCom period, there's no significant difference between those two lines. So hospitalization rates for people in Dauphin fell 8.5% relative to the control group simply by introducing a basic income. I looked a little bit closer to find out what codes were responsible for the hospitalizations, and there were primarily two. There was a reduction in accident and injury hospitalizations for the Dauphin residents. Now, accidents and injuries, a huge category that accounts for a very large proportion of acute hospitalizations. And there's no surprise there, because whenever we look at the relationship between poverty and accident and injury hospitalizations, there's a strong correlation. If people have more money to take care of themselves and their families, they're much less likely to be hospitalized for accidents and injuries. The second was an interesting finding. They were also much less likely to be hospitalized for mental health issues. And so those were the only two significant causes of the fall in hospitalizations. I found a similar kind of pattern for visits to family doctors. And again, when I looked at the codes to find out why people were going to family doctors less often when they got a basic income, the only thing that turned out to be statistically significant were mental health issues. So they were less likely to go to a family doctor complaining of anxiety, of depression, family conflict, sleep issues, and so on. Were there other effects? Well, there were. And in some ways, kids might have been the most affected by this experiment. Go back to those young unattached males. The men were staying in high school longer. The boys were staying in high school longer. If the boys weren't leaving high school, their girlfriends weren't leaving high school either. They weren't getting married at 17 or 18 and having three babies by the time they were 21. So one of the findings was that these families had their first child at a later date relative to the control group. They had fewer children over a lifetime. And both of those are associated with better outcomes for both the children and the parents over the lifetime. How did the families perceive MnCom to have affected their lives? I love this woman. Amy Richardson was one of the recipients. That's a picture of her. She died a couple of years ago, and she became a strong advocate for basic income in the last few years of her life. She was a young mother of six children, and she was married to a disabled husband. And in fact, he died during the experiment. She always worked, but she was self-employed. She ran a hair-cutting operation out of her kitchen, so you can imagine she wasn't making a great deal of money. She had six kids, and she says she used the extra money that she got from MnCom for luxuries in her life, things like school books. And you can imagine what people's lives are like, right? It was to bring your income up to where it should be. It was enough to add some cream to the coffee. And here's the significant point. Everyone was the same. Everyone was the same, so there was no shame. Eric Richardson, her son, was about 12 years old when the experiment ran, and he remembers MnCom vividly, which you wouldn't expect for a 12-year-old. But he remembers it because it was the first time he ever went to the dentist. All of his brothers and sisters were taken to the dentist when the MnCom money came along. And Eric was one of that cohort of young, unattached males who actually was able to finish high school during this period rather than going to work at the age of 16. So, what happened? 39 years after the end of MnCom, Canada got interested in basic income again. And in 2017, the province of Ontario decided to use MINCOM to design a new basic income guarantee experiment. And the idea behind this experiment was very, very similar to MINCOM. It was going to be a 3-year experiment. There were going to be 2 randomized controlled trials that would take place in different economic regions of the province. So there would be 1,000 subjects and 1,000 controls in each of Hamilton, which is an urban center, a lot of big city issues, and Thunder Bay, which is a smaller resource-dependent town. And there was also going to be a saturation site in the town of Lindsay. So there would be 2,000 subjects in Lindsay. And Lindsay was in the manufacturing heartland of Ontario. And the idea was that a lot of jobs had been lost in Lindsay in recent years. We'd be very interested in knowing how a basic income would affect the town. This is the former Premier of Ontario who introduced the experiment. And the purpose of the experiment was very different from MINCOM. MINCOM was interested in labor markets. The Ontario experiment's also interested in labor markets, but from a different point of view. Instead of worrying about whether people would quit their jobs or work fewer hours, they were interested in knowing whether people who received a basic income might be better matched to their jobs, whether they might end up with better jobs than they would end up without a basic income. But the primary purpose of this experiment was to look at poverty reduction. They intended to follow secondary effects on mental and physical health, child development, human capital formation, and community outcomes. And one thing that they were particularly interested in was whether a basic income could help the province control the escalating cost of delivering health care. I should say that in Canada, health care is delivered by the provinces, and about 50% of the budget of all of the provinces is now going to the support of health care. And so provinces are seeing the cost of healthcare escalating. And the idea was that if you can invest a little bit of money up front, if you can invest a little bit of money with families before they get sick, will we see it in terms of less demand on the healthcare system to treat the consequences of poverty as opposed to bad luck or other effects? So who would qualify? This was set up as a payment for adults, so 18 to 64-year-olds. One thing that made it quite different from the existing benefits package is that individuals would be able to attend school, so they could go to university if they wanted to, which is not possible under the existing income assistance scheme. It includes people with disabilities. The payment was based on family income. There's an additional child benefit of about $6,000 per child. And there's an additional payment for people with disabilities. And how would they know if the experiment worked? Well, we were tracking all kinds of things. We were tracking using administrative data and using survey data. We were tracking effects on health, on career choices, poverty reduction, food security, education, financial decision making, but also things like perceptions of citizenship and inclusion, community impacts, and the government was interested in administrative costs and impacts on other social programs. So everybody was very excited about this project. Sampling began in the summer of 2017. It was complete by 2018. Provincial election occurred in May 2018. Liberal government was badly defeated. It was replaced by the Conservatives, and the project was canceled in July 2018. No data was collected except for the baseline survey, and that is the current status of the project. I should say that the Minister of Social Services announced the cancellation of the project in the press. There were no details given, no communication to the subjects in the experiment for a month. No idea how long the participants would continue to receive the stipends or how they would be transitioned off the programs. When they called, they were referred to a website which told them they would receive the August payment. On August 31st, the minister announced, again in the press, that the payments would continue until March 2019 to give participants time to adjust. So, that's at the stage for a sort of an unanticipated experiment, because suddenly you can ask the question, what happens when a basic income experiment is prematurely dropped? what happens when you take away a basic income? And in particular, what happened during the 30 days of uncertainty before the clarification of the status of the participants? And I can report some of this because of things that have been happening for the past month. There are real concerns, real fears about the status of some of the participants in the experiment. As you can imagine, many of the people in the experiment were vulnerable before this began. They didn't need the heightened uncertainty in their lives. There are lots of reports in the press of people who made decisions to improve their lives and now find themselves in a position where they've signed leases for apartments they can't pay for. They've registered for courses they can't pay the tuition for. And people feel betrayed, quite rightly. And I just want to share a couple of the emails I've received, and I'm sharing this with the permission of the participants. And I think you should listen to the words people use when they describe the situation they find themselves in. This happened in the first month, before participants knew what was going to happen to them. And as I said, I'm sharing this with the permission of the person who wrote it. This person says, "I was not surprised that so many of the disabled ones were, like me, survivors of child sexual abuse, with chronic health problems, lifelong mental health and addiction problems. Being in the pilot works so beautifully for those of us with high ACEs scores." And of course it does. ACEs scores are adverse childhood experiences. It's an attempt to quantify an exposure of a child to physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. "We never had any security, and to get it, some of us for the first time, unleashes our potential in a million ways." This is a different person. "I wanted you to know you, proponents of basic income, not me personally, made us feel like we mattered. The wards of the state who were harmed in foster care, who were never helped by medicine, who've been ostracized over and over and over. I want to say that there's a special place in my heart for those in the pilot whose trauma was grossly misdiagnosed as psychotic illness by mental health system." Here's the third person. "I'm having bandwidth problems due to the trauma that makes some of my other trauma symptoms flare up, sort of. Migraines that went away in the pilot are worse than ever. They started coming back after the election, though. I could see the handwriting on the wall." I don't want to focus on this, but I mean, I said when I began that we've made all the mistakes that it's possible to make with the project. And, I think it's easy for governments sometimes to forget that we're actually dealing with people. You know, there's a confusion between an experiment and a policy, and there's not a culture of research in governments that run projects. And so this kind of trauma is having an effect, I think, throughout the system. I think one of the things I'd like to do is to just step back from this a little bit and to ask some of the bigger questions about the relationship between a basic income and health outcomes. I think that I should say that I'm a health economist and I work in a busy downtown hospital in Winnipeg. And I spend a lot of time working with statistics and working with data and working with costs and so on. But it doesn't take very long to walk through the hospital, to walk through the hallways of the hospital, and to realize that when you're talking about healthcare costs, you're actually talking in many cases about the cost of poverty, that we spend an awful lot of healthcare dollars dealing with the consequences of poverty. And I think we know, there's no surprise to any of us, that poverty and poor health outcomes are really strongly linked. But I don't know that we necessarily have a very good handle on what the pathways are, how poverty brings about poor health outcomes, and more importantly, how a basic income could actually change possibilities for people. And so one of the things I've been trying to do is to untangle that knot, if you want, to focus a little bit more clearly on the different aspects of income and how income is associated with health outcomes. And so I want to talk a little bit about four possibilities. The first, I think, is straightforward, and that's material deprivation. The second, stigma. The third, income insecurity. And the fourth, income inequality. And I think I want to talk about two different aspects of income inequality, two different ways, I think, that inequality affects health outcomes. We've all seen diagrams like this, looking at social determinants of health. They're all a little bit different depending on what part of the world or you live in or who put it together. In the Canadian case, it's assumed that about 50% of our health is determined by the social and economic circumstances we find ourselves in. And another 10% is associated with the physical characteristics of our neighborhoods. So more than half, 60% of our health is actually determined in some way or influenced in some way by our income. And you can compare that with the healthcare system bringing about 25% of the health results we face. And I think when we focus on material deprivation, this is the story that's most consistent with the story we tell about the social determinants of health. And it's easy to tell that kind of a story. A basic income gives people the resources they need to buy nutritious food, to access better housing, to pay for better childcare, to buy health services not provided by the government, to send your children to the dentist in Canada, for example, to pay for your pharmaceuticals, which are not covered by the health by the government health care plan. But that's only part of the story. One of the things that comes across very clearly when we talk about basic income is the idea of stigma. And this isn't associated with my work on basic income as much as it is all of the work that we do relating income and poverty to health outcomes. One of the things we see in all of our research is that even if you control for the level of income people have, even if you control for material deprivation, families who receive income assistance do worse than families who receive income from wages. Now, it's not clear why that is. Some of it is because, no doubt, there are unobservable differences between these two groups of families, and that's bringing about some of the reason. But I think some of it is also associated with the idea of stigma. And stigma has a debilitating effect in two very different ways. When we talk about stigma, we often talk about the ways that we deliver social assistance and how people are identified or made to feel different. And so your mental health suffers when you're identifiable to others as a recipient of aid. I think we spend a lot less time thinking about how stigma affects us because we've internalized the social messages that shame people who receive assistance, even if nobody knows they're receiving assistance. We do it to ourselves. People do it to themselves. Income insecurity. In the literature, there's a lot of confusion, I think, between material deprivation and income insecurity. But these aren't the same thing at all. Someone with a stable, secure, but low basic income might suffer from material deprivation, but they don't suffer from income insecurity. Income insecurity means that your income is unpredictable. It's potentially unstable. And there are two sources that I think really bring that to mind today. First of all, as employment becomes more and more precarious, that becomes a source of income insecurity. People never quite know how many hours they'll work next week, how much money they'll bring home. But the other source of income insecurity are the benefit systems we have in place. When our welfare system is based on arbitrary decision-making by frontline caseworkers, when it's based on 800-page manuals that you can't possibly comply with, people never know with certainty how much money they're going to receive from month to month. And it's very difficult to plan. When some people receive benefits that other people don't receive, because of the discretion of a caseworker, that's a source of economic insecurity. So how does economic insecurity affect your health? The theory posits that this works through chronic stress, and the medical literature is completely full of the health effects of chronic stress and all kinds of outcomes. Links to chronic conditions like diabetes, links to birth outcomes, certainly links to mental health. And I don't need to list this because we all know that this is all over the medical literature. The The third thing I want to focus on is income inequality. And again, the literature has focused a lot on rising income inequality, but I don't think we've necessarily picked apart the pathways by which income inequality affects our health outcomes and how basic income might help. The story that's traditionally been told is that inequality affects individual health because people experience envy and chronic stress when they compare themselves. They make upward comparisons with others. But there's a second pathway that's becoming increasingly entrenched. Income inequality affects mental and physical health by breaking down the bonds of social solidarity. And it shows up through things like housing segregation, through changes in the nature of the religious establishments people attend, through educational segregation, private schools and private universities playing a greater role, lack of access to internships and social networks that facilitate success. And these changes all close doors for people at the bottom of the income distribution. So it's not simply the amount of money, it's the way in which that plays out through society. So let me go back to the question I had a minute ago. I see I've lost it. And that is, how can a basic income affect, thank you, how can a basic income improve health? Well, at a very basic level, giving people a basic income can eliminate material deprivation, right? If a basic income's high enough, you get money into people's hands, people can buy access to the services they need, they can buy nutritious food, they can rent better housing, and they can access the resources they need to provide better for themselves, for their families, and their children. Basic income does a wonderful job of addressing economic insecurity through its insurance effect. If you think back a minute to the story I told you about Dauphin and kids completing high school, those are huge effects for a fairly small town. Why are we getting such strong educational outcomes? And I thought about that for a long time. Why would a little bit of money cause so many kids to go back to school? And I think you want to put yourself in the mind of a 17-year-old boy trying to decide whether to go to grade 12 or go get a job working on the railway, right? He and his family are going to think about how much money the family has. Can they afford to support him for another year? Can he afford to stay in school? But for the 17-year-old boy, that's not the primary concern. He wonders what his friends are doing. He cares about whether his friends are going back to school. And if his friends are going back to school, he's much more likely to go back to school. So this affects not only the people who receive the money directly, it also affects people in their social networks. Society itself changes. The way we make decisions as a society changes when people receive money. So not everybody has to receive it. And I think that when we talk about income insecurity, this insurance effect, people know, even if people don't receive basic income today or don't need basic income today, they know it's there. They know it's there if they need it, in the same way that the healthcare system is there if you need it. And it creates a kind of a kind of security in your life that allows you to take risks and allows you to make changes. Okay, income inequality. Well, basic income is much less adept at dealing with income inequality through income redistribution. And that's because if we introduce a basic income, all we're doing is setting a floor, right? We have income inequality not because some people are poor, but because some people are colossally rich. And I think if you want to talk about addressing income inequality through income redistribution, you've got to talk about the other half of it, and that is how we're going to change the tax system in order to pay for a basic income, which we've not done here. But I think one thing that basic income might do is to enhance social solidarity, right, that second pathway, by giving those people at the bottom end of the income distribution the resources they need to participate much more fully in society. And we're back to stigma. Stigma can be reduced by delivering basic income anonymously, but we can do that with any social program. We can deliver it well. It's not 1974 anymore. People don't have to line up to pick up their check on the corner. But the hardest problem are the internalized social attitudes. And I think those are much, much harder to change. And so I think I want to leave you with that last question. How can a basic income, not just Canada, but how can a basic income encourage us to re-examine the ways that we value ourselves and that we value one another? How can it make us ask some questions about how we relate to the labor market, how we relate to the world of work, and how we relate to the people around us? Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you would like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.